Okay, so the very limited knowledge I have about the religious traditions of the Buddhist time are gathered both from my much earlier training in philosophy of religion and also 3 years practice of tantric yoga. So a little bit of experiential background, but dominant religious tradition of his time, the one into which he was born, variously referred to as Hinduism or Brahmanism, and the way that it configured the understanding of spiritual experience was one in which there were these figures, one of them being Brahman, okay, and that is the sense of the divine, of the universal divine, the divine that inheres in all things, the divine that inheres in all creation, okay, and that manifests in various forms at various times in history, and that to some extent has the potential to manifest in each human being. Okay. So this universal spirit, okay, that inheres and imbues all things, potentially, okay, can be cultivated, can be brought forth through various practices and religious rituals, and through living a life of integrity. As one begins to develop this inner sense of the Brahmanic, okay, of the divine within, okay, begins to manifest as something called Atman, and the higher self or the true self that begins to arise within one. And then the overall goal of spiritual maturation in this system was that one would continually purify oneself through various cycles of reincarnation, drawing ever closer to union with Brahman, okay, and then the ultimate manifestation of this particular spiritual path was the union of Brahman and Atman, okay, out of which arises the experience of what's called moksha, or liberation or enlightenment. So this was the understanding, the structure, the tradition to which the Buddha was born. What seems to have been going on in his society at the time is the sort of thing that tends to happen after any dominant religious tradition has been in place for a while. The poet John Chiarity once wrote a poem in which he included the lines, "If you can afford to, call God. If a religion answers, hang up." And Carl Jung has also observed at one point that he said that religious institutions are a defense against religious experience. So that once a set of teaching gets institutionalized, once it's imbued with the power of the state, the power of society, that somehow or another it can begin to lose track of what it was originally about. And so would seem to be the case with regard to Brahmanism at the time of the Buddha. The caste system in India was already very crisply defined. And as the caste system was being practiced and as it was being taught to the people at large, the teaching was, well, whatever your station in life, if you adhere to the teachings and you adhere to the rituals, and you're a good and faithful servant, whatever your station happens to be, then you may be gathering enough merit in order to attain a favorable reincarnation. Okay. Either within your same caste, or if you're really good, you might actually be reborn into the next caste. And so through your rebirth, through your reincarnations, you work your way up through the caste system until you're born as a Brahmin. And the Brahmin was the top tier. The Brahmins were the priests. They are the religious leaders of the society. And as it was practiced, this system had, it was, what it was basically doing was using religion to reinforce the caste system, essentially. And as it began to take on more and more of that purpose, it seemed to do less and less good a job at actually helping people, whatever their station in life, to live with integrity, to treat everyone else with mutual respect. So it had become kind of calcified by that point in time. So rather than, and the Buddha, when he left, he was the next caste down, the kingly caste, he was being groomed for, you know, heading up a government and decided to follow another path. So when he went into the wilderness and became an ascetic and then came back, he was really aware of the fact that a lot of what the structure of the religion was supposed to be about, in terms of training people to live with integrity, treating each other with respect, but not had really been lost. And there was a lot of reliance just on the practice of rote ritual, that many of the people of high caste are not living lives with integrity at all, including those within the Brahmana castes. And then when he began to teach, he said, well, you know, he was very much an empiricist, you know, rather than simply taking anything at face value. His ultimate goal, as he would say over and over again, I want to find out why there's suffering in the world and how that suffering can be brought to an end. And when he began deep inquiry into that, and particularly he was talking about the kind of suffering that the mind creates for itself. Certain forms of suffering are visited upon us just by virtue of being in a body. You know, we grow up, we age, we become infirm, we die. We're subject to accidents, subject to illness. We are social beings, and so we know the ecstasy of intimate connection with others, and we know the grief that comes with their loss. The kind of suffering he was focusing on mostly was that having to do with the activity of the mind itself that generates harm or suffering for oneself and for others, how it can be brought to an end. And he said, when I sat for these 6 years, inquiring into the nature of the mind, looking at these various practices and teachings and trying them out, and judging them all against this goal of whether or not they aid in bringing self-caused suffering to an end, he said, I came to the conclusion that based simply on my own experience, some of the things that we have been taught, some of the things that we have received in our practices, in my own experience, I do not believe to be true. So what he posited, and again, one of the things I'd like to reinforce over and over and over again, when he offered these teachings, you know, people would come and say, well, why should we, you know, listen to you? We've got these various teachers telling us how it is, you know, what the nature of the universe is, what the nature of the cosmos is, what our role in the cosmos is. And he said, it sounds to us like you're kind of doing the same thing. And he basically said, no. Please abide contemplating the possibility that what I am saying is true. Not just drop some other creed or teachings from mine. Listen carefully, compare what I'm telling you to your own experience. See if what I'm saying rings true for you based upon your own experience. If it does, you may want to inquire further and you may want to do some of the practices that I recommend. If you do not find that to be so, let it go. So in that regard, it might be best to sort of consider the Buddha as perhaps like a theoretical physicist. He's saying, it may be like this. Okay, let's play with this idea. Let's see if as a result of playing with this idea, you find yourself getting closer to the goal of the end of suffering. Okay, if that works, fine. Otherwise, there's nothing more than a thought experiment. Go sit with somebody else. So the way I like to hold these teachings sometimes is, and one of the things that's always fascinated me about space travel is how the people who control these vehicles are able to attain the speeds necessary in order for them to fly through space to Mars and elsewhere. And the vessels themselves don't have the thrust to do that. They don't have the fuel. So what they do, using Newtonian physics, is to aim at the sun. And as the vessel gets closer and closer to the sun, it accelerates faster and faster and faster because it's being drawn by the sun's gravity. And then just at the point where it looks like the vehicle may be drawn into the sun, then they fire the rockets to break it free of the sun's gravity as well. It's kind of like a slingshot. And so the vessel then goes out into open space at a highly accelerated rate of speed. It's freed from the gravitational pull of both the Earth and the sun. So for me, the Dharma teachings, to a remarkable extent, are kind of like that. I use them for the purpose of freeing myself from the cultural gravity field that I was born into, and freeing myself from the structures that I was taught as to how things are, how it is, you know, looking at the possibility that, well, maybe it's not. Or just like Newtonian physics, which is highly applicable within its own realm of context, right? It was Newtonian physics that allows to explore space, but it was taught, and it was taught right up through the time I was in school, this is how it is. This is the nature of the universe. This is how it all works. It's a great big clock. You know, everything obeys these laws, end of story. Well, turns out, not so much. That those laws have enormous applicability and validity within a certain frame of context. But there are other entire realms in which they just don't apply. And so for me, it's helpful, and I think to some extent the Buddha intended that his teachings be held in this way. See, I'm not telling you how it is. I'm suggesting that you consider the possibility that what I'm telling you has some merit, has some truth to it, is in fact the Dharma. The reason I suggest you explore these teachings and consider the possibility that they have merit, that they may be true as a way of understanding your own spiritual experience, is that they lead to freedom. Okay. So when he put forth his teachings about anatta, that's what he was doing. He was saying the tradition that we have received is one that posits a universal consciousness, an external deity, an external spirit that we become one with, that our own eternal spirit or soul becomes part of. So in my own empirical inquiry, I did not discover there to be a universal oversoul or all-abiding spirit external to ourselves. Moreover, he said, I did not discover there to be a permanent and abiding self. So through my own inquiry, my own examination of what was going on in my own mind, the conclusion that I've come to is that what we think of as Atman is the permanent and abiding self. You know, and this is a structure not just used in Hinduism, but in most of the theistic traditions, the other Western traditions as well, in some form or another. He was saying, I think that it's not so useful necessarily to posit this universal being out there someplace that we become a part of through the vehicle or kind of the body itself. He said, in my experience, the oversoul doesn't really exist in the way that it's taught us, nor does the permanent and abiding self. In fact, he said, among the causes of suffering that I discovered for myself is clinging to the idea that there is a permanent and abiding self. Just like clinging to rites and rituals is a path to enlightenment rather than understanding and following their deeper meaning. That attachment to sense desires and their gratification is another form of clinging that causes suffering to occur. Therefore, he said, I think that what we think of as the self, what we think of as permanent, what we think of as this entity that transmigrates from body to body over time, is a fiction, is a comforting fiction that we hold to in order to try to believe that we don't die when we die. That there is an eternalism about us. Okay? He said, in my experience, this simply isn't true. So I think that what we believe to be, or what we construe to be, what we rely upon as a sense of this is me, this is who I am, this is unique, is nothing more than the moment-to-moment fabrication of the mind, the discursive mind. That essentially, literally, we make ourselves up as we go along, and once we've come gain some insight into how it is that we make ourselves up as we go along, should we decide that we want to experiment with doing so, we can stop it. We can cease to fabricate the self and experience life, see the world, not through the eyes of self, but to see the world as it truly is. You know? Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment, the Buddha said. See the sweet joy of the way. Free from fear and attachment. You know, there is a really interesting saying from the Hindu tradition. It says, you know, whether a pickpocket is in a crowded bazaar with other shoppers or a holy temple with other worshippers, he still sees only pockets. The relationship between motivation and perception. Okay. So that as long as we are perceiving the world from the vantage point of self, from the self that has fears and desires, we cannot see the world as it truly is. And we act accordingly. So the Buddha said, key to learning how to cease causing suffering for yourself and others is to learn means of experiencing existence and seeing the world through non-self-referential eyes. In order to be able to do that, he said, you need to use your powers of insight when you're doing this meditation practice, to be able to break apart, to disassemble, to disaggregate, okay, to deconstruct the sense of self in ways that allow you to see its fundamental emptiness and therefore be free of it. So you're becoming free of the gravitational pull of the self, of the habit of mind for doing that. Then, of course, comes the little instruction manual on how to do that. But before we go there, any questions or comments about anything that I've raised so far in this notion of anatta? No, atman, anatta means opposite of atman, not atman. Yeah.
Please. How does reincarnation jive with what you said about no, nothing after this?
Yes. In the Hindu tradition, and in some others, there is the understanding of the principle of reincarnation, which is to say that all of your behaviors, all of your thoughts, all of your speech, all of your actions in a lifetime are like planting seeds that will later yield fruit, that you will... karma is generally, the word is generally taken to understand or mean our actions and their fruition. That based upon the actions we take, the words we speak, how we live our lives, okay, that we will either cause suffering for ourselves and others, and therefore as a result be reborn into another existence where we endure the same suffering over and over again, or we will start cleaning up our act and changing our ways during the course of a lifetime, thinking, speaking, acting, living our lives in ways that are in harmony, that are compassionate, that are kind to oneself and others, So you start generating good karma instead, which you cash in when you get reborn the next time into a more favorable existence. And then you, so there's, that's the notion of the permanent and abiding self that transmigrates from existence to existence. That's the model that the that was extant in the Buddha's time that everyone believed in. That model, he said, is the one that I don't think is true. I don't think it's that's really how things work. So he didn't, in Theravada Buddhism, in Mahayana Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism, which is kind of a mixture of some core Buddhist teachings with tantric yoga, then they do speak of reincarnation. They do speak about their teachers who reincarnates of previous great teachers down through history. The language in the Theravada tradition from which I'm teaching, the Pali Canon, doesn't talk about reincarnation, it talks about rebirth. So in this understanding, to the extent that anything does make the transit from one state of being to another, from one sentient being to another, okay, it's not an intact personality or identifiable self. Okay. It's more like sending somebody an e-note. Okay. Are there little letters that travel through, they fire out the cable that land on your computer screen? No. They're pulses of energy. Okay. There are pulses of energy that are driven by intention. They're driven by the intention of whoever it is that's writing you the e-note. You know? And that that intention may or may not find expression in the reader. Okay. So something far more subtle than that. Okay. One of the images that I like to play with is the one that Buddha actually used in talking about the nature of consciousness. You know, he said, when all is still and the mind is free from fear and attachment and is in a deep state of peace, okay, he said, the consciousness can float light as thistledown. So you think of like, you know, dandelion puff, you know, on a breezy day, and it sort of goes flying off. And so, and then this is getting metaphysical, which the Buddha didn't necessarily recommend, but. One way that I've heard the alternative view of the Theravadins expressed in this regard is that, and this is for people that were asked to explain this memories of past lifetimes and things like this. Imagine that there is a vast field, sort of like, I don't know, huge, huge open meadow or a big valley that stretches off into infinity in all directions. And that this great field is essentially the space-time continuum, okay, that Einstein talked about, like a vast sort of matrix, right? And the thistledown, a puffball, may come to a light briefly at one of those intersections. Some place in time. Here's where it gets interesting. Because maybe this is basically the model of there, of course, being no past and no future. So that the thistledown may briefly come to a light at different points in the matrix. Okay. 1657 in Florence. 2500 BC and somewhere in Mesopotamia, right? And then it may pick up in a light elsewhere. So rather than there being this kind of continuous thread of me, myself, and I stretching like some thread across history, it's much more subtle than that, much more floaty, okay? So there's still this, and there can be information transmitted, you know, kind of like when butterflies pollinate, you know, that sort of thing, that maybe the same kind of thing is going on, but it's a lot more subtle than the other model. Okay. So that's just sort of one way of thinking about it. And at the same time, the Buddha said, please be careful when we're talking about these ideas, please try to remember as best you can the reason why we're having these conversations in the first place. And the reason why we're having these conversations in the first place is so we can inquire into the nature of mental activity and the ways it might be able to cause suffering. So what far too easily happens instead is that we kind of veer off into metaphysical speculation about how it is or how it may be or how we think it is. And then, and as soon as we start down that road, you know, is there a self, is there not a self, what happens when you die? That we kind of start to lose track of what the intent of the teachings is in the first place. And the intent of the teachings is to use, to hold this teaching of anatta as a way of exploring ways in which we might be causing ourselves suffering and how we can bring it to an end. So, what is it that we experience instead of a self, if indeed it's possible that the Buddha may be correct? How do you experience yourself now? How do you experience being alive? What does it consist of for you? What do you think of, well, this is who I am. Okay. What comes to mind? Hmm?
The senses.
A sentence?
The senses.
The senses, exactly. Well, as it turns out, that's where the Buddha started. He said, that which we think of as a permanent and abiding self is nothing more than a rapidly occurring sequence of mental processes, of forms of awareness. Okay. And that there are five components to this thing we call self. Okay. The sort of five ingredients, you know, you're putting together a BMAC, right? You got your sesame seed bun, you got your patty, and you got your lettuce, and you got your tomato. So one of those ingredients is nama rupa, what the Buddha called a name and form. The body and its ability to experience sensory input. Okay? Next thing is consciousness, one's ability to understand the sensory input as it comes in, understand it to be what it is, recognize it for what it is. Next thing is vedana, which is another mental process that judges all the sensory inputs as being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay? Free from fear and attachment. This is very, very deeply wired, hardwired sensory interpretation, the means by which we avoid harm and gratify our desires. Right? So, we've got the body, we've got consciousness, which has the capability to interpret the sensory input. We have the capacity to judge whether the sensory input is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay. We have the ability to interpret the sensory input. The mind really wants to know what it is that's coming its way, right? So first to judge it as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, but then to turn the microscope to the next power and have a closer look at exactly what it is, right? And so that's where perception comes in, which is the fourth of these five ingredients that go into making up the self. Having perceived what it is, whether it's an olfactory input or a sight or a sound. Have you ever noticed how experiencing fragrance can bring back memories? Okay. Or a sound, whether you find it be pleasant or unpleasant or whatnot. What's going on then is the fifth ingredient coming into play. Sankharas, the mental factors, the memory bank. So you've got the body with the sense apparatus, you've got the ability to interpret sensory apparatus, you have the sensory input that you judge to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You give a label to the sensory input, then you grind through the memory bank to see if you have any pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral memories of that sensory input. Those are the five ingredients. They're called the skandhas. And that word literally in Pali, the way that it was, it's referred to is that if you have a place where different grains are stored, okay, then somebody who's coming to, like in a royal household, you have a grain store, okay, and there are these different piles of grains. There's millet and wheat and corn and rice and whatnot. And so whoever it is putting it together, the day's recipes, goes into the grain store and obtains as much of these different grains as they need in order to put together the menu for the day. Okay. Skanda means heap. Okay. And a heap made up of infinite particles. Okay. So basically, and the Buddha, again, he was teaching, you know, in an agrarian society, so he's always looking for these similes that people could kind of relate to. So he said, what's going on is that the mind is aggregating, is pulling together these different ingredients, okay? And they're just the five ingredients that just hang out there. What brings them together? The special secret sauce. And he described what we incorrectly think of as the self, as the five aggregates affected by clinging. Okay. So, when the pickpocket is in the crowded bazaar with other shoppers, or the holy temple with other worshippers, you know, his special secret sauce is a desire to see them, to get it, to look at them, find the pockets, right? So he's driven by desire. He's driven by thirst to see the world in a certain way. And basically, the Buddha says, that's what we do too. When we perceive the world, when we take in the sensory input and judge it to be pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, bundle it up with our memories, okay, that what we're doing when we're creating the self is that we're doing all of these things with intent. The intention being to either gratify sense desires, or to avoid harm, okay? And as long as those are the two drives that cause the interpretation of those five coming together, those five aggregates coming together in a certain way, that's the self. So if we're constantly in a state of need, for instance, then we're always scanning the environment, and there's a personality type, the Buddha called me, sort of the greedy type, the one whose consciousness is driven principally by a sense of unrequited, unmet needs, a hunger, okay, that they're always reaching out for something they don't have, okay. Cannot stand the light, as in Tocqueville, with some of these words when he was describing Americans, you know. All of their needs have been satisfied beyond measure, but there's a sadness that hangs over them, for they cannot stop thinking of the good things they have not yet got. So that's the state of mind of wanting. Okay. So the five aggregates affected by clinging can also be that somebody is a highly aversive personality, that they live in a constant state of anticipation of the worst, of anxiety, of concern for bad things that might happen. So their view tends to be one that's imbued with a state of aversion, an aversive personality type. So as long as one of these motivations is being used to process and edit and give meaning to all the sensory input, we thereby create a sense of self. What the Buddha said is possible to do under some circumstances, okay? And this is the reason why from that time to this, there's so much emphasis put on retreat practice, on residential retreat practice and meditation. And the reason for that is that when you go on a retreat, one of the very first things you do is you take vows. You take vows to come together in spiritual community in a certain way. You vow to do no harm, you vow to not take that which is not given. You vow not to hit on each other in a sexual way. You vow to not lie, and most inside meditation retreats it's about noble silence, okay? You vow not to get ripped on anything, okay? You keep the mind clear, okay? So these are promises that we make to each other on retreat in order to create a place of sanctuary, a place of refuge, of safety. In other words, a place where the mind doesn't always have to be worried about the stuff that normally is out there in the world. Your food is being provided for you. You don't have to worry about starving, although sometimes on retreat, people sometimes think they will anyway. But, you've all taken vows of non-harming. You don't have to fear harm from anyone else who's there. You're taking vows of truthfulness. You don't have to worry about being misled. Okay. So in other words, a space has been created where all these things that tend to drive the creation of self have been removed. And you're invited to simply sit and watch the mind as it is. Okay. Sometimes people like what they see. Other times, not so much. Because what we find is that the mind continues to function in the old way. It continues to bring up either pleasant memories or things we've longed for. It tends to bring up bad things that happened to us that we're afraid may happen again. Okay. So we go about creating these stories of the past and the future, sitting in a place of complete safety, where all of the external threats have been removed. And we're simply left to watch the activities of the mind. So it can be a difficult practice to be on retreat, but the other thing it does is provide enormous insights into the conditioning of the mind. And little bit by little bit, in that situation, you find the mind beginning to relax and to not make up as many stories about the past and the future, and to come to a more peaceful and immediate relationship with the present moment. And it's in this kind of setting, and it is indeed possible to do it. This happens faster on retreat, you go deeper. But if you get a regular daily practice going at home, on any opportunity that you take where you can really practice, let the mind get quiet, you can see the same thing happening or beginning to happen. You can begin to get some insight into how and why the mind goes about creating the self. And then you can also begin to get a glimmering of it, an understanding of how it might be possible to not live in the old way, but to find some place of inner peace, of inner refuge, of inner sanctuary, where you can watch the arising and the passing and the changing, the passing away, the eternal flow of ceaseless, ever-changing experience, and you can come to know who you are as part of that flow rather than necessarily being apart from it. That's where the Buddha was headed with his teaching. Okay. Please, let's discuss. This is pretty core stuff, and the more we play with the ideas and can abide contemplating the possibility that this is so, that this is what's really going on in the mind. Okay, there is no great and powerful loss. There's just a little guy or a little lady back here behind the curtain punching buttons and turning the wheels, right? It's all quite mechanical. And that it's definitely worth pulling back the curtain, contemplating the possibility that this is so, and then reflecting on, well then, who are we? How should we live our lives? How do we define who we are? How do we make our way in this world? Please.
So, let's say you do all of that. You get there and you realize there's no self. You have to get up the next morning and go to work and deal with your husband. And you have to pretend like you're still self. How do you live a life where you're really living a fiction? Yeah. If what you're saying is true.
Sure. It's what Carlos Castaneda called a controlled folly. The question was, so you have, you know, in Zen is called Satori, in Theravada Buddhism is called the experience of Anatta, the experience of Naso. So, great. So that happens, and then you still gotta get, you know, it's like Rambha said, used to say, you know, it's great to become one with the divine, but don't forget your zip code. You know? That you really do need to stay kind of grounded in material reality for the time being. Anyway, so indeed, life goes on, you know. One of the ways that it was among the most ancient teachers of this concept, when he was called into the court of a Greek king who had just got through conquering a part of Northwest India and was asked to kind of answer the very same question he just raised. He said it can be useful to think of this constructed self as a kind of a vehicle. He said, oh great king, you know, how did you come to your castle, to this palace here today? He said, well, I rode my chariot. He said, what is your chariot comprised? He said, well, there's a platform, there's an axle, and there's two wheels, and there's a fence around it, and there's this tongue that sticks out that the horses are attached to. And he said, right, and when you're answering the question, how do you arrive here? You say, well, I came here standing on this platform with axles and wheels and a little fence around it. I said, no, I said, you call it a chariot. It's your vehicle, but you are not your chariot, right? It's a means by which you get around. Okay. So, in much the same way, every morning we wake up and brush our teeth and whatnot, it's like we're slapping together our chariot. You know, we're pulling together the vehicle that we're going to use to tool around town that day. Answer emails, pay bills, you know, be in relationship with a significant other. Okay. But we're doing it from a slightly different point of view, because we realize that even though I'm performing these functions are not who I am in the ultimate sense. It's great, you know, gig if you can get it. However, what you'll often begin to find is that as soon as you do come into the air, you can have, you know, kind of wonderful software experience when you're sitting or whatever, and then you go into work, and then there's somebody at work you don't particularly get on with, you know, and all of a sudden you're into it, right? And what you've done, as soon as you find yourself in conflict or some kind of adverse relationship or aversive relationship or situation, is you just conjured up the self. Okay. But when you have this insight, you know, once you have this, have a kind of little flash of insight into what it's like to experience life from the not-self point of view, then when you see that happen, once you've really spent some time looking at the mind, you say, oh, here I am, constructing the aversive self. Here I am having thoughts on the parentage of this person I do not like. Here I am wishing harm to this other, whether I do it or not. Okay. So you realize that what you've done is to construct a self in the moment. It's in an aversive state of mind. That is feeling fear, that is feeling anger, that is inclined to act upon it. Okay. If the emotion is strong, the insight kind of melts away. You act on the fear, you act on the anger, and as a result, you generate some kind of unwholesome karma for yourself that's going to have to be dealt with somewhere down the road. The value of the insight practice is that over time, you find yourself in the aversive situation, you feel the anger growing, you identify it. See, anger arises, fear arises, okay? And then what oftentimes arises after the feeling of fear is some kind of planning, something you might do or say to protect yourself, to ward off the other, perhaps to inflict harm. And then you watch that intention arise. And that's the point where the freedom really lies. It's not that the aversive state of mind comes up, it's what you do about it when it does. If things are moving so fast, if you're on this kind of express train of rage or whatever, it manifests into words, it manifests into action, and harm is created. If you can see it arising and you realize what's happened, you have enough experience from looking at your own mind to be able to, it's like thinking through chess moves, you know, three or four moves ahead. If you can see the anger arising and you're thinking, I might be getting ready to say or do this, you can also see two or three moves down. What's the likely outcome going to be of me saying or doing this? What's going to be the outcome for me? What's going to be the outcome for the other? And is there a possibility of not doing it? You know, following a different path instead. That's where the real deconstruction starts to take place. That's where the transformation of unwholesome karma to wholesome karma begins to take place, where things start to get melted away. And it's as a result of looking at the behavior of ourselves in the world in a different way. Rather than, this is who I am, I've been wrong, I've got to do something about it, I've got to stand up for myself. Sometimes you're going to need to, no two ways about it, but it will be as a result of reason deliberation rather than being thrown by the power of your emotions into actions that later on you may regret. Kind of like writing an email but not sending it, you know. Thank you, great question. Please.
I still grapple with the question, you know, what is the ground of morality?
Yes.
So the Buddha dismisses the notion, you know, some sort of theistic explanation, which is convenient. I mean, what's the ground of morality? God, ta-da, you're done. But it has practical implications if you don't have any. I mean, for example, you know, if I go into work and I'm pissed off, but I refrain from saying something, not because I have empathy for the person that I might attack verbally, but rather because I don't want to get fired.
Yeah.
Don't I have different assumptions about what the ground of, than if I say, if I refrain from saying something hurtful because I suddenly experience empathy with that other person?
Yes, thank you. There is that common misconception, okay, no God, nothing to worry about, no point about things, go behave however you want to, no big deal. Pretty much the antithesis of what the Buddha taught. You know, one of the reasons that the icon of the Dharma chakra, the Dharma wheel, is so important as a teaching device in Buddha Dharma. You know, each of the eight spokes in the eightfold in the Dharma wheel represented an aspect of the eightfold path. You know, effort, mindfulness, concentration, insight into causes and conditions, insight into intention. Those are the five of the eight spokes. All of the spokes need to be of equal strength to balance each other out. The last three spokes of the wheel is the manifestation or the fruition of your meditative efforts and your insights into speech, action, and way of life. Absolutely as important as the meditative factors, absolutely as important as the insight factors, is the ability and the importance and the necessity of acting with integrity in the world. So he taught that all the time. And then I guess maybe part of what you're asking is, okay, well, if that's part of the teaching, where does that intention come from? There's no self. Right. Where the intention comes from is insight into what the consequences would be if you behave badly. You know, if your meditative capabilities are such, and your ability, you know, the wisdom factors, you know, your ability to have insight into your past history of behavior and its consequences, that you can see when the potential for behaving badly arises, you can say, okay, I could speak, act in this particular way with these likely consequences, or I could speak and act in another way with other probable consequences, or I could do nothing. Okay. So it's from insight into the ways we've caused harm for ourselves and others in the past that we have some ability to reflect on, might it be possible to follow a different path? And that's where the morality definitely comes in. Behave differently, speak differently than we might otherwise have, in a way that's still true to yourself. If your feet, it doesn't mean being a doormat. You know, if you've really been harmed in the past and wronged, and there's a felt need to kind of protect yourself, right? Especially if you are anticipating or experiencing harm from another, then by all means, you need to do what is necessary in order to take care of yourself. But hopefully, kind of like a defensive martial art like Tai Chi, instead of one like Taekwondo where your intention is to crush the other guy's hands out, I mean, basically all you want to do is prevent them from harming you by creating sort of a cocoon of inviolability. And so it's speaking and acting with different motivation, with an intention of compassion, you know. But it's kind of replacing one set of motivations with another. It's motivations based on insight. What the Buddha said was that it's not simply abandoning one form of self and adopting another form of self. When you have enough experience in being able to see how the mind creates the self, gradually you begin to be able to trust that as a result of that insight and as a result of the compassionate intention that arises in the mind as a result, that you can trust the likelihood that you're going to speak and act in a more skillful way. That's the rap anyway. And we all play that game better sometimes than others. But that's the idea. Yes, please.
Can I ask you something? When you were talking, I was thinking that you made it sound so simple. The cycle-dependent origination, could you say that the birth at the end of the cycle is the birth of the self?
Are you talking about dependent origination? Okay, well, this is a preview of coming attractions. That's what we're going to talk about next time we get together.
I was thinking, yes, it is. That's one way of interpreting it. But then I was thinking, if we don't complete that cycle, then there is no self. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're not starting with the self.
Right. What's being referred to is another kind of related concept, especially in the Theravada Buddhist canon, it's also the Mahayana as well, and it's called the cycle of dependent origination. Okay. So what I've done is to describe the fabrication of self, okay, with five aggregates affected by clinging. How that happens on a moment-to-moment basis. The cycle of dependent origination is one that is a somewhat more elaborate model that sets those five or six steps within a larger ambit. And it goes into more detail as to how we whip together the self on this moment-to-moment basis, but then kind of what happens afterwards in terms of whether the self gets strengthened and reified and causes even more, deeper and more unfortunate forms of misbehavior than before, and then how that cycles into the state of mind affecting one at the moment of death, and then how that might affect what happens the next time around. Yeah, at any rate, we'll talk about that in considerably more detail at some future time. Right now, I wanted to just have us work together with this, with the front end of the thing here, how we bring the self into being and how we can invite the self on occasions to not be. Yes, please.
I was just thinking about the role of metta or loving kindness or self. Compassion that it is sometimes referred to in some forms of Buddhism as kind of somehow allowing you to open up or get
Yes.
To what's going on in time.
Yes, thank you. The really important question has to do with the relationship between this concept, this idea of not-self, and the cultivation of compassion in Buddha Dharma. And in fact, the two go hand in hand, and they must in order for genuine awakening to occur. There is a phrase that you find, especially in the Mahayana tradition, they refer to wisdom and compassion as the wings of awakening. It's like, just as a bird cannot fly with only one wing, so too must there be both wisdom and compassion in order for full awakening to occur. You know, and the Theravada monk, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, has a book called Wings of Awakening where he talks about just that. Because you can have this erudition, this wisdom, these insights into the nature of not-self, but it can also feel very cold and lonely, and in some cases somebody taking only that teaching alone, one extreme might say, well, none of us exist, nothing matters, it doesn't matter whether we suffer or not, you know, in a kind of a nihilistic approach. On the other hand, in order for that teaching to have its intended effect, because there can be at some point, you know, and not infrequently, when someone has the experience of Satori or Anatta, whatever you want to call it, different traditions frame it in different ways. Sometimes what can immediately occur after the experience is that once you realize that you've had that experience, you're not in that state anymore. When you label something as anatta, what you're labeling as anatta as a memory, it's the state of mind that you had previously been in. And what can sometimes happen at that point is actually a certain amount of fear that someone experiences the dissolution of self, the deconstruction, the disaggregation of self. And they're very concerned that maybe they won't be able to put themselves back together again, you know, or that they won't be able to adequately protect themselves or fulfill their needs if they're not doing it from a place of self. And so that concern or that anxiety that can arise is in fact a form of suffering. And in this understanding, it is the frank acknowledgement of suffering or dissatisfaction that has the effect of summoning forth compassion. Compassion for oneself and compassion for others. So that's why when you're holding, inquiring into a teaching like anatta, it's really important to do it from a field of compassion. Because, you know, as it's sometimes been described, you know, as I said in here before recently, that one way that the spiritual path is sometimes, especially in Buddha Dharma, is sometimes described as a process of grieving. Because what you're doing is letting go. Letting go a little bit by a little bit of things as you thought that perhaps they were, when in fact, perhaps they're not. That who we thought to be ourselves, us, me, my, and mine, okay, maybe not so much. Maybe it's a construct, maybe it's a fiction, maybe it's something we just do with our mind. And if that's all we really are, and it's possible to train the mind to not do that, then how do we make our way in the world? How do we remember a zip code and our social security number and the other things that are necessary to make our way, you know, at the material plane? So, aside from those who decide to become ascetics, take on robes, become, you know, enter the monkhood, where their needs become simpler, we still need to make our way in daily life. And we still need to do it. But we do it with a somewhat different spirit. We do it out of compassion for ourselves, out of kindness, rather than out of fear and longing. Very different motivation that has the result of us perceiving the world and interacting with others in a very different way, a different spirit. That's the wrap. The living of it is, of course, the ongoing challenge, and that's why we call it practice. And so I'm looking forward to us meeting again soon to continue this discussion. For the moment, however, may we just very briefly get back into our sitting posture. And allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. May we live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May we know ease of well-being. May we know the joy that lies within us. May we rest in silence and in stillness, and no inner peace. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. May we be awakened.
Night, everybody. Have a good week.